void. Up next on Think, learning to accept bugs as not just inevitable, but invaluable. We'll spend this hour with entomologist John Hines. Earlier in his career, he worked on products like the mosquito repellent Off and Raid insecticide. But during a fellowship at Yale, where he studied religion and ethics, Hines started thinking about the responsibilities humans have to other creatures who share our environment, including those we think of as pests. We'll learn some fascinating things about insects, spiders, and centipedes, and consider the moral implications of killing them on sight. Our conversation starts after a short break. Years ago, we had fruit flies move into our house. Out of nowhere, we found them hovering over the fruit bowl and buzzing around the kitchen sink. So after consulting the internet, we set out a couple of little dishes of apple cider vinegar with a squirt of detergent on top. And within a few days, our unwanted house guests had departed. Well, let me not euphemize this. They were dead. Our home remedy killed them, and they did not come back. Fruit flies are kind of gross, though, but they're not dangerous. Was it wrong to kill them without thinking twice? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. John Hines is an entomologist and ethicist, an affiliate at Seattle University Center for Environmental Justice and Sustainability, and president of BioOpus LLC. He's been fascinated by bugs since he was a kid, but he's also killed more than his share. In fact, early in his career, Hines worked for the company that makes the mosquito repellent Off and the all-purpose insect killer Raid. Since then, though, he's had a bit of a change of heart. And at the very least, he wants us all to understand that wantonly killing the creepy crawlies that freak us out has a greater effect on the environment than most of us bother to consider. His book is called Nature Underfoot: Living with Beetles, Crabgrass, Fruit Flies, and Tiny Life All Around Us. John, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You say humans have a moral obligation toward other living things and that a truly astounding amount of killing is taking place. That's a quote in farm fields and houses and cities and towns. Why do you think we find it so easy to kill weeds and tiny creatures with six or eight or dozens of legs?
Well, I think it goes back both to how we feel about these smaller organisms, and also how we think about them. How we feel about them is generally with feelings of fear and disgust, and that leads us, I think, to feel more comfortable about killing these smaller organisms. But we also have a history of not regarding these insects, weeds, and other small organisms, not regarding them as of having value, and that they don't have moral value. That is, it doesn't matter to us what's right or what's wrong for those insects, so we can pursue our own ends without being concerned about them.
Do you have more to say? Please continue.
Oh, okay. Well, so that's sort of historically, and it goes as far back as Aristotle, early Greek philosopher, and goes back to an idea that the things that we value or that have moral value are things that have things that are irrational beings that have consciousness. And there's a philosopher whose name is Peter Singer. He's at Princeton. Mm-hmm. And he talked about a concept of a circle of moral concern. And Peter Singer points out that over time, our circle of moral concern has widened. At one point, maybe in Aristotle's time, it would have solely been Greek citizens and probably just male Greek citizens, slaves, people from other countries. Women might not have fit inside that circle of moral concern. Well, obviously today, I mean, that moral concern, circle of moral concern has widened, and it extends, I think, in many people's minds, well beyond human beings, certainly to other sentient creatures, oftentimes not as far removed from us as insects and plants. But I point out in the book that there are philosophers who say we should look even further. And using sentience or rationality to determine what we should care about, what we should have moral concern for, is probably arbitrary. Hmm. It's that all living things are deserving of moral consideration.
It is really strange. I mean, I have friends who have really fretted over discovering, like, a nest of possums living under the house. They can't really let them stay there for a lot of reasons, but they've worried about what to do and tried to find, humane ways to remove them. On the other hand, most people I know don't feel bad about attacking a wasp's nest with a can of poison.
Yeah, so this is the difficulty, right? It's when we're in conflict with these organisms, with the possums or with the wasps. And I think the simplest way to think about it is when we are in conflict and when we are endangered or when our food supply is threatened, for example, when our health is threatened, I think it's permissible to take action to reduce that threat or eliminate that threat. And if that extends to killing another organism, that's the way of the world in reality. So definitely we all have the right to self-defense. We can be smart and try and be smart about how we do that. Maybe the use of pesticides isn't necessary. Maybe there are other ways to manage the concern. But sometimes it is. Things like mosquitoes that carry malaria, mosquitoes that carry West Nile virus, or ticks that carry Lyme disease, those are threats to human health, and it's definitely permissible to find ways to manage that threat.
Right. So, of course, we don't want people to get malaria. We don't want pregnant women getting Zika virus. Mosquitoes cause problems for humans. On the other hand, you say you often get asked whether the planet needs mosquitoes at all. What is their use in the ecosystem that we tend to undervalue?
Well, they definitely have a place in the ecosystem. If you asked a scientist whether we could get by without mosquitoes, I think the answer is probably yes, we could. But there's other reasons to care about them beyond what role they have in the ecosystem. Aldo Leopold, an important environmental philosopher, I would say, talks about our kinship with mosquitoes. We have, evolutionarily, if we go way back in time, we have common ancestors. Genetically, we share genetic material. We have similar genetic material, more similar than people realize. And ecologically, we are interconnected. There's no question. So there's a number of other reasons to care about what happens to mosquitoes. And there's the idea also that these, as another living organism, they have some inherent worth or inherent value that belongs just to them.
David Quammen, the science writer, told you maybe mosquitoes have a value in protecting ecosystems because they keep us out of certain places?
Yeah, that's right. That's a quote from David Quammen that's in the book. His sort of provocative idea is that mosquitoes are part of protecting some natural places and keeping humans away.
I want to talk about how you arrived at these conclusions, because as you admit in the book, you wanted to make a career out of studying insects, but got a job that required you to find the most effective ways to kill them or drive them away.
Yeah, so I guess I would have always characterized myself as an environmentalist, perhaps a pragmatic environmentalist in my role as a pesticide developer. My idea was that I was helping people, providing them tools that allowed them to make their lives better in one way or another, when they were threatened by insects or had concerns about insects. And so That was my point of view working in the pesticide industry. I hadn't really thought very much about, well, hardly at all, about the value that these organisms might have in and of themselves. And I really was exposed to that line of thinking after I retired from the pesticide company and decided to return to school. And you might say I got religion. I went back to school to study religion with an interest in how does religion speak to the environment and to our environmental issues today. And so I pursued at Yale, I pursued a degree in religion, a master's degree in religion, with a concentration in ethics, but really focused on the environment.
So did that cause you to be uncomfortable with your career working in the pesticide industry? I mean, did you have to reframe your identity?
Well, I don't know about reframing my identity. I think that I became aware, I guess, of some concerns that hadn't occurred to me previously. And the first semester in a class, the first semester I was at Yale, we were talking about, well, how do you decide which organisms, which animals, which are deserving of our moral concern? Which animals should we be concerned about? What's right or what's wrong for them? Can we take actions against which animals and without having moral concern? And that's what kind of got me started thinking down this path about these smaller organisms, these insects and spiders and millipedes and weeds. And so that sort of started the process. It's something that I hadn't really, well, I hadn't considered at all as a graduate student or working at the pesticide company. Insects were simply a means to an end in those activities.
One concern you have today is that sometimes when we buy a can of pesticide, it will sort of boast on the label that it will keep on killing for 6 months or a year. We may not need to keep on killing for 6 months or a year, and that may be a kind of dragnet for a lot of other creatures that we didn't intend to harm.
Yeah, that's definitely one of my worries. I think people buy pesticides. They aren't trained to use them. They oftentimes don't understand what it is they're doing. They may not be aware of this long-lasting insecticidal activity. And so one of the issues with the insecticides that we can buy on store shelves today is that there is a fair amount of collateral damage. We might have a particular target, a cockroach in our house, that we are spraying this pesticide for, but it's going to be around for a while. And so perfectly innocuous insects may crawl over the residue from that pesticide, and they will be killed too. Similarly, when we spray outside, we often kill things we didn't really mean to kill. We spray plants to control pests like aphids, and maybe we end up poisoning butterflies or bumblebees. So it's this whole issue of collateral damage and not recognizing the effect, a broader effect an insecticide can't have. It's really an issue.
My guest is John Hines. He's an entomologist and ethicist, an affiliate at Seattle University Center for Environmental Justice and Sustainability, an adjunct faculty member at Seattle University. We're talking today about his book, Nature Underfoot, Living with Beetles, Crabgrass, Fruit Flies, and Tiny Life All Around Us. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd speaking with ethicist and entomologist John Hines about his new book, Nature Underfoot, Living with Beetles, Crabgrass, Fruit Flies, and Tiny Life All Around Us. All right, John, so in making your case for thinking twice before we just wantonly eliminate things that we think of as pests, you tell us a lot of interesting stories about things that are often the targets of herbicides and insecticides. Let's talk about dandelions, because kids love them. They're kind of a scourge of people who wish for a perfect green lawn. I hadn't realized that every little petal on a dandelion is actually an individual flower.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, dandelions are fascinating plants, and it's a great example of how these common organisms, these common plants that we see in many yards and actually don't really want around, if you learn a little bit more about them, can become much more appealing. And you're pointing out one of the really interesting things about dandelions. They produce these large inflorescences with the flowers, multiple little tiny flowers that make up what looks like to us as a single flower. And those produce just a ton of those seeds, the big seed ball that you can blow into the air, and carry dandelion seeds pretty much everywhere, as people can attest.
So we're not going to get rid of them anytime soon, regardless.
You know, they're a great example of the kinds of organisms that do really well in human-built environments. We create environments with lots of open space, which is great for dandelions who like a lot of sun, and we have lots of little gaps in our lawns where the seeds can fall and grow. And so there's this whole group of plants and animals that are really successful at sharing our space and getting along with us. And dandelions are a great example of that. And so long as we continue to build the way that we do create these wonderful environments for dandelions, they're going to be with us for sure.
Crabgrass is another one. We've put in place conditions that sort of scream for crabgrass to grow there.
Yeah. Crabgrass, they're a really happy beneficiary of the way that we manage our yards and build our environments. And they've been with human beings for a long time. The close relations of the crabgrass plants that we try and manage in our lawns, they are a food source for human beings and a food source used for domestic animals as well, like cattle, the seeds. Crabgrass is another one that benefits from the big open spaces that we like for lawns and that sort of thing. Great places for crabgrass to grow, too.
Your book did make me feel a little bit bad about getting the fruit flies out of my kitchen. It turns out they are beloved subjects for people doing lab experiments. What kinds of research questions have fruit flies helped to answer?
Oh, it is amazing, the range of things that fruit flies have been used to study. They are so well known for the learning that scientists have obtained about genetics, famous for learning in genetics. And, they're used today for college students learning, and even in high school, learning about genetics and observing changes in fruit flies, what color their eyes are, what their wings are like, what color their bodies are, and watching how those traits are passed down among fruit flies. But they are used for a lot of other kinds of studies, too. One of the studies that I point out in the book that surprised me was they're being used in research to understand how alcohol is processed. Fruit flies are quite happy to feed on fermenting materials, including alcohol. And so they actually provide really good information on how alcohol is managed physiologically. And so, yeah, alcohol use, old age. There's all kinds of studies now going on looking at aging and fruit flies who reproduce very quickly, as you know from your experience in the kitchen.
Yes.
They're great subjects for these aging studies.
Is there some reason why fruit flies specifically are such good subjects?
Well, I think part of it is because they reproduce so quickly that you can have multiple generations in a very short period of time to observe effects. Part of it is they're easy to rear. Scientists have really gotten that process down, people that work with fruit flies. And so they're easy to work with, easy to manage in the lab, and you get multiple generations of them. So they're a really convenient study animal.
So we're not happy necessarily to see them in our homes, but you point out in the book that they have evolved because of the conditions we've created. So like they're now adapted to the constant food source they can find in a kitchen or a grocery store or somewhere. We made it possible for them to be around all the time.
Yeah, that's so true. I mean, it's another one of these organisms that have really adapted very well to life with human beings. And, you know, these particular kinds of fruit flies, these Drosophila fruit flies, it's harder to find them in the wild now. The place, if you want to find them, you would be more successful looking around human habitation than you would be further out and looking for them around their sort of ancestral host plants and that sort of thing.
There aren't a lot of champions of dung beetles walking around, but you can count yourself among them. They're not anyone's favorite creature, but they're very useful. What would the world look like without dung beetles?
Well, dung beetles are incredible. And you can look to Australia, where they imported cattle. Cattle were not, of course, native to Australia, this, you know, separate continent that's so separate from the rest of the world. They imported cattle, and it didn't go so well. You might say that the Aussies were knee-deep in cow manure. Hmm. They didn't have dung beetles that could process this more moist manure. They did have dung beetles, but they were specialized to process manure from marsupials. But so Australia is having this problem. The cows weren't happy. Their pastures were full of poop, and the Australians weren't happy. And so they imported dung beetles that were able to manage cow manure, and it kind of saved the day. The dung beetles rolled up the cow manure and buried it and managed it. And they still, for that reason, they still have cattle in Australia today. So dung beetles are incredibly valuable. There's papers now that where people are talking about the contribution of dung beetles to reducing the gases that go into causing climate change by processing manure in the field. So they play an important role there too.
We're often dismayed to discover that moths have been at our winter clothes over the months that they've been stored away. What did moths eat before humans walked around wearing wool sweaters?
So, yeah, moths haven't always been feeding on sweaters. They evolve feeding on dead animal skins. They're one of the few animals that can feed on keratin, this very and very dry skins, and survive. So they're really interesting that way. And I think, you know, over time, it's tough to find dead animals, and so their survival depended on it. What we have now provided to these moths, we human beings, is a lot more predictable food source. You know, we've got sweaters and that sort of thing, that wool garments that work really well to rear clothes moths. Sadly for us, it's sometimes disappointing to open your closet and find holes in your favorite sweater, but very happy result for the clothes moths, who also are less likely now to be found outside of human habitation than they are to be found within human habitations.
So their natural habitat is like our closets now?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, they are really well adapted to living with us. They can manage the really dry environments that we have in our homes.
How come we see evidence of moths, but we so seldom, like, it's not like you open your closet door after the winter and 11 moths fly out. Where do they go?
Well, actually, it's not the moth itself that's feeding on your sweater. It's the caterpillar or the larvae of the moth that are feeding in your sweater. And so those caterpillars or larvae do some feeding and make these holes, and then they crawl away to pupate like a butterfly might and pupate and then later on become adult moths. So after they've done their work, you may not find them anywhere near the holes in your sweater. They've crawled away elsewhere.
Lots of people these days are freaked out about bed bugs, which have come like roaring back into our consciousness after almost being eliminated by the introduction of DDT, which of course we don't use now. One has to admire their ability to communicate with one another through chemicals. How does that work?
Well, it's true of a lot of insects that they communicate via chemicals. And one of the things that bed bugs do is they produce something called an aggregation pheromone. And so it's a chemical that bed bugs detect. They're very sensitive to, and it identifies a place where a lot of other bed bugs are living, and a place that presumably, since there's so many living there, that might be a safe place to spend the night, you might say. So that's one of the elements of how bed bugs use chemicals to communicate. They also use chemicals to find you. Carbon dioxide, what you exhale, what you respire from your body, is an attractant for bed bugs, as well as heat and moisture. These are the ways that they can crawl from maybe a crevice under the mattress up to the bed and find you. And
I feel like you're making people itchy just with those words.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, people have a hard time with bed bugs. I'm not quite sure what it is. Maybe it's the fact that it's all happening while you're sleeping and are vulnerable.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So, John, what are the ethics? What's the morality of trying to eliminate bed bugs with like a, I don't even know what you use, like an insect bomb or something? Should we find a way to live with them if we have a bed bug infestation?
No, I don't think you need to find a way to live with them. That would be pretty uncomfortable. I guess fortunately, bed bugs aren't known to carry disease, so they aren't life-threatening or something like that. But I don't think anybody should feel they need to live with bed bugs. It's really difficult to get rid of bed bugs, as anyone who has had a bed bug infestation will tell you. And it's even hard for professional people to get rid of bed bugs. I have a friend, an entomologist, a professor who had bed bugs in his home, and it took him a long time to figure out how to manage the problem. So it's challenging, and I wouldn't recommend that anyone try or undertake getting rid of their bed bugs on their own. I think that you need to involve a professional, and they need to be knowledgeable about, if they are going to use insecticides, just where to use them, because using a bug bomb, I'm sorry, as you suggest, probably is not a great idea. We really need to be a lot more targeted. It's really not necessary to spread insecticide throughout the home or throughout the bedroom or that sort of thing. If you're going to use insecticides, you need to be more targeted. Today, people are using things like heat to kill bed bugs. They'll heat up a room or individual items from a room to the point where all the bed bugs are killed. And that really helps. And you can do some of that yourself by putting things into your dryer if you think that they might have been infested with bed bugs.
Some of the environments we've created have made really excellent habitats for creatures we may not want around. On the other hand, some of the things we do without malice toward insects have been really bad for them. Can you talk about how cars have affected the population of flying insects?
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, one of the things I guess I'd point out immediately is that, and this is anecdotal, but my experience, I don't know what your experience is, but my experience is that I am seeing less insects on cars than I used to. And that goes back to another story, which I won't get into now, but the idea that there are fewer insects around, truly fewer insects around. And I'd be curious if your listeners are experiencing the same sort of thing, whereas 30 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, they used to see a lot more insect spots on their cars than they do today. Things are changing for insects. One of the animals that I talk about, the Heinz emerald dragonfly, it's up in Wisconsin and Illinois and Michigan. It's an endangered species. It's regarded by the federal government as an endangered species. One of the issues this dragonfly has is cars. It's got a number of problems. It lives in a very specialized habitat. A lot of those habitats have been destroyed or fragmented by human development. But one of the problems it has is it flies at a level that is just about right for cars to run into it. And because it's an endangered species, obviously there's not a lot of them around, so everyone you lose is tragic. And so efforts have been made, interestingly enough, to try and reduce those car dragonfly collisions, including putting up barriers to make them fly higher over the cars and a variety of other things.
My guest is entomologist and ethicist John Hines, an affiliate at the Seattle University Center for Environmental Justice and Sustainability, and author of Nature Underfoot, Living with Beetles, Crabgrass, Fruit Flies, and Tiny Life All Around Us. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with entomologist and ethicist John Hines. He's an adjunct faculty member at Seattle University, president of BioOpus LLC, and author of a book called Nature Underfoot, Living with Beetles, Crabgrass, Fruit Flies, and Tiny Life All Around Us. John, a lot of Americans have been, whether they're religious or not, have been shaped by kind of Judeo-Christian beliefs that tell us that humans are more valuable than other animals, that animals exist for us to do with as we please. Some people challenge that notion when it comes to larger creatures, and there are other religions and belief systems that take a very different position on all of this. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So within the Judeo-Christian religion, there are a number of stories that people refer to that kind of guide that way of thinking. And I think that one of the things, the creation stories are a big part of that. And one of the things to keep in mind is when you look closely at the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, is used by Christians and by Jews. There are multiple creation stories, and not just one or two. And these stories give us different ideas about our relationship with other organisms. People point to a second creation story in Genesis that tells us we ought to be stewards of the environment. The first story in Genesis, people point to as suggesting that we have dominion over the earth and can do with it as we will. A lot of people will argue that, well, that's not really what's meant by dominion. I like to point at the book of Job in the Hebrew Bible, where there is an element of humility for human beings that's introduced, and God is talking to Job and his and the people that are with him, and saying to them, "What do you know about creation? What do you know about the environment? do you know how the eagle is fed? I mean, I'm paraphrasing here, you know, and what can you control? And I really like that because I think in reality, what can we control in our world? I mean, we look around and many parts of the environment are sort of spiraling out of control because of human, some of the things we do as human beings. And so I think that humility is a really important piece to take away. Humility in terms of the human role relative to the environment. So that's Judeo-Christian religion. That's what's so wonderful about these religious traditions. There's just so much there, and it requires a lot of thought to think about the different parts and kind of put them together and see what makes sense, particularly in our world today. And you think about any of these religions going are all quite old, and the environmental problems that we have today were not anticipated by the people that of the time that these texts were written. For Buddhism, for Christianity, for Hinduism, for Islam. So it's really fascinating to see, to ask yourself the question, well, how do these ancient traditions, these wisdom traditions, how do they talk to our current situation with the environment? What can they tell us?
We have an email here from Mellon who wants to know if you'll discuss Jain philosophy.
Sure. Yeah. So Jain philosophy is sort of an amazing extreme. And the Jains will walk around dusting the earth in front of them to make sure that they don't step on any living thing. They don't eat at night. Because for fear of accidentally not seeing something in their food, some small fly or something that's landed there and ingesting it. They're careful to eat in the daylight. They're careful about the kind of clothes they wear. So the Jain philosophy is quite consistent with the idea of respecting other organisms almost to an extreme.
All right, let's go to the phone. We have Bob on the line in Dallas, Texas. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I just agree 100% with your guest today. Years ago, when I first moved into my house, did the normal thing, put out the fertilizer, put out the, you know, the weed killer. I turned my whole yard with triazinon and everything else, getting rid of fleas, into a toxic waste dump. I way overdid it. And for 2 years, we didn't have a bug, and I mean not an ant, not anything in our yard. I've quit that. I've gone basically to zero scaping, you might say, because I realized the environmental damages that I was doing. And now we have all sorts of things growing and all sorts of different kinds of bugs and wasps and dandelions and you name it, we got them. But they all balance out. They're part of nature. They take care of each other, and it really works. We don't have bug problems. We've got a sort of a strange-looking yard, but, you know, we don't have, you know, because it's not just grass, you know.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Bob. Is there anything you wanted to touch back on there, John?
Well, I heard Bob say xeriscaping, and I think what he means there is that he's putting native plants into his yard and managing his yard really based on the soil types and the climate that that he experiences in his area. And I think that's admirable. I mean, it's fantastic. And it really helps all those native insects and other organisms that want the native flowers, that want the native plants to feed on. It really is, what he's doing in his yard sounds admirable. It's great.
You write here about hoverflies, which this is so interesting. They have bodies that look like stinging insects. They look a little bit like yellow jackets or bees, but they don't actually sting. Tell us a little bit more about these guys.
Yeah, hoverflies are amazing. And I think probably all your listeners would recognize them. They're the little tiny flies that that can seem to hang in the air. People often will call them bees because they're yellow and black in color and with stripes. They look a lot like bees or even wasps. And, of course, that's their way of mimicking bees and wasps is their way of defending themselves. Some predator might think twice about trying to catch them because they look like they might sting. And there's even some hoverflies, if you grab them, will push with their abdomen on your skin as though they're actually going to sting you. Of course, but they can't. So yeah, they're amazing. And they're really beautiful little insects. Wonderful to have around your yard. They're pollinators. And their younger stages, the larvae or caterpillars, can be do a variety of things depending on the species. Some are recyclers, breaking down organic matter, and some are predators and feed on plant pests like aphids. They're really incredible insects. Hoverflies are fabulous.
You raised bees for a while on a friend's farm, not just for the honey, but like to connect with the bees. What did you learn about them by closely observing them that just as an entomologist with your training, you wouldn't have known if you hadn't had that experience?
I raised bees when I was in graduate school. And, it was an opportunity to learn a little bit more about another insect and maybe learn it a little more intimately because bees are a domesticated animal and they benefit from human interventions. So you want to place your hive in the right place where it gets morning sun, but not the hot late afternoon sun. In the winter, and this was up in Wisconsin, in the winter months when it gets so cold, you need to be careful that at the end of the summer or fall, you haven't taken so much honey out that they can't survive the winter. You need to leave them enough honey to get along through the cold winter months when they're cooped up in the hive. Bees are amazing. That it's really a treat to work with them and benefit from the honey as well. So,
this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Do we know why they produce a surplus of honey? It would seem like a maladaptation that they're making much more honey than they need to survive.
Well, they don't really make more than they need to survive, but if you take honey away, they will replace it.
Okay.
So they're making plenty for their hive, and as I say, they need it for sure in the winter months to survive. That's how they make it.
How does a queen bee restart the colony for bumblebees, which I gather die off otherwise every year?
Yeah, so bumblebees have an annual life cycle. They form a nest, and that nest lives through the summer and into the fall, and then dies off. And the nest produces queens that mate, and then in the fall they go off and find a place to hide under some bark or in a hole. And in the spring, they come out again, and in a lot of parts of the country, they're doing that right now. They're out feeding on flowers for nectar, and then they're going to find a hole in the ground, like an old rodent burrow, and that's where they will start their nest. And then as the summer goes along, the numbers of bumblebees build up, and it gets to be a large nest of bumblebees. Bumblebees are actually our most important native pollinator, wild native pollinator. They, of course, the honeybees are really important, but those are domesticated. And some bumblebees today are domesticated as well, but they're the most important pollinator we have that's a wild pollinator.
Have we figured out why so many bee colonies are collapsing?
So that's with honeybees. We have this, what entomologists often refer to as colony collapse disorder. We are losing a lot of honeybees. And part of that is probably due to a virus. Part of that is due to other organisms, mites, for example, that that get into honeybee hives and can kill them. Another element may be the way that we manage honeybees these days. So the professional beekeepers often move hives all across the country, and I try and tell the story of something like that in my book. I talk about a sort of fictional bee yard where bees are moved from South Carolina all the way out to California to pollinate almond trees. And if you think about it, you ask yourself, well, why is that? Well, part of that is because almonds in Central Valley of California cover such a large, huge area. But it's also because we have lost so many native pollinators. Hmm. And we move, I don't remember the numbers, but as a shocking a number of honeybee hives to California to pollinate almond trees. Maybe two-thirds of the hives in the United States are found in California at the time of pollination for almonds. And then they're moved to Michigan for blueberries, say, to Washington for apples. They're moved all around the country. And that may create some stress for honeybees. And that may be contributing as well to some of these colony losses.
When it comes to coping with insects that we have considered pests or hazards, you say we need to separate human need from human convenience and greed. How do we know, John, when we've crossed the line?
Yeah, that's what's really difficult, right? When we're in a conflict with an insect or a weed or something like that, it's what are our perceived needs? I think all we can do is ask ourselves how important it is to have that insect out of our living environment, for example. So, yeah, that's a tough one. But that's part of why I wrote the book. Hmm. I want people to be a little bit more aware and to think a little bit, maybe think twice when they encounter that cockroach or silverfish.
John Hines is an entomologist and ethicist. His book is called Nature Underfoot, Living with Beetles, Crabgrass, Fruit Flies, and Tiny Life All Around Us. John, thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you, Chris. I really appreciate it.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Subscribe to our podcast by searching for KERA Think. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.